I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio. Tonight, WGBH's Frontline presents a two-hour documentary on the AIDS epidemic in Black America. Here's some staggering numbers to consider. Every 10 minutes, someone in the U.S. contracts HIV. Nearly half of the 1 million people in the United States infected with HIV are Black men, women, and children. How's this epidemic playing out in Greater Boston's Black community? That's the question I'll be putting to Dr. Bisola Ojukwutu. She's with the Mass General Hospital and serves on the board of directors for the AIDS Action Committee. Dr. Ojukwutu, I can get it, Ojukwutu.
Yes, that's good.
You and a lot of your patients you're working with a lot of patients that are HIV infected. What does the epidemic look like in Boston?
So I think that's a really good question. Let's start with the good news first. If you look over time since 2000, the actual number of HIV cases, new cases of HIV that we're seeing, has actually decreased by over 50% in Massachusetts. So that's great news. If you look at outcomes in terms of HIV for people, you know, living with HIV here in Massachusetts, quality of care is high and survival is high and the death rate is actually lower than it is nationally. Some of my colleagues have actually looked at viral suppression rates. Viral suppression basically means the amount of HIV in the blood, and we want that to be undetectable. And that's a sign of, you know, good outcomes and good survival. It's actually higher here in Boston than it is nationally. Mm. And if you look at differences by race, they're really insignificant. So Boston has made some really great strides in terms of both, really decreasing the problems that are faced nationally in terms of HIV. But the bad news is that in terms of prevalence, you mentioned a lot of numbers in terms of the racial and ethnic disparity in HIV prevalence, and we see that here in Boston also. If you look across Massachusetts, only 6% of the population here in Massachusetts is Black, yet upwards of 30% of the HIV/AIDS cases are in the Black community here in Massachusetts. And the prevalence of HIV in the Black community is actually 10 times that in the white community here in Massachusetts. So we really have some stark and striking and really disturbing issues in terms of disparity, in terms of prevalence of HIV here in Massachusetts.
Well, let's tease out a few things that you put here, put out here for us to ponder. One, the reason that we're doing better here, resources are better. Why? I mean, it's because Boston is a big medical center. Is that why?
Well, it's multifactorial, but I think that the big issue, the quintessential factor, is healthcare reform. Massachusetts implemented healthcare reform back in 2006, and that really increased access to Medicaid as well as other forms of insurance for low-income individuals. And access leads to better care. You know, access to care, we know, leads to better survival for people living with HIV. On top of that, it's what you mentioned. I mean, we live in a city that's full of great medical centers. You know, I literally have patients who've come to my office to interview me as an HIV AIDS care provider.
Wow.
And then, you know, they've compared me to other people. And, you know, sometimes they come back, you know, hopefully more often than not. And then on top of
but
that,
they have choices.
Right. They have choices. That's my point. Exactly. Yes, they have choices here, which they don't have in other states. And then there's also the fact that we have a lot of people here who are extremely strong advocates and who are national leaders in HIV who are working, you know, here in Boston. And we have great community-based and AIDS service organization like AIDS Action Committee and others who are tirelessly advocating for, you know, better and improved care for people living with HIV. So I think we're living in a pretty good situation in terms of access to care. And this is what's led to the outcomes that I've mentioned. But the disparities in terms of prevalence are really still there and they're still striking.
Well, let's turn back to the prevalence. One of the things that we hear is that in the community, and we're going to be speaking in generalizations just for the purposes of this conversation, in a Black community in Boston and certainly nationwide, is that there is a huge stigma against the disease still. And then we're talking 30 years after it was detected in white gay men, and lots has been out there in terms of awareness, public service, changing in attitudes in general by Americans. But studies show, in fact, one you all did that the stigma is really intense in the Black community.
You're absolutely right. And I think that that's something that's very concerning. It's not just stigma towards HIV and, say, you know, how you feel about somebody who may be living with HIV or do they deserve to be infected. We're really talking about stigma in regards of sexual diversity and issues of same-sex relationships and homosexuality and the things that people, you know, to sort of strongly associate with HIV. The study that we conducted with the Multicultural AIDS Coalition, which is another one of the community-based organizations that's out there in Boston that was funded by the Centers for AIDS Research at Harvard Medical School, actually was a survey that we did. We basically did street outreach. We went to the Black community in Boston. We went directly to them. We went to Upham's Corner. We went to Mattapan Square. We went to outside of Roxbury Community College. And we just randomly assessed people's understanding of HIV. So we looked at HIV knowledge. We looked at HIV stigma. We looked at whether people felt they were at risk. And we looked at whether or not they had been tested. And the results were disturbing. You know, I'll say the good news first, again, HIV knowledge was rather high. I mean, people know how people contract HIV. People know that there's treatment
available.
The
correct way.
Yes. Okay, their knowledge is good. Mm-hmm. But in terms of stigma, the stigma was high. And even when you look at other studies in the past, I mean, maybe stigma has decreased over time, but it's still too high, you know? And then on top of that, that's even, you know, more concerning to me as somebody who's very interested in both treatment and care as well as prevention, is that people underestimate their own risk of infection. So even though they understand that HIV is out there and HIV is a concern in our communities, what does it translate to in terms of your own life, in terms of your own behaviors? That was concerning as that we found in the study.
So just to be clear, the stigma about HIV is attached to people's perception of gay people, and let's just put it on the table, homophobia. So if there's homophobia and the stigma attached to HIV is linked, which then has an impact on people's awareness and people's even following up for treatment.
Right. So the stigma is associated to the issue of homophobia. But the stigma, I think, relates to sexuality in general. There's a lot of silence and a lot of people not talking about sex, not talking about it, you know, to their children, not talking about older people, not talking about it, even though they're doing it, you know, and not thinking about sexually transmitted diseases and not thinking about all the things that are associated with sex. So it's beyond just homophobia, but the homophobia is a huge component of it.
We're talking about the AIDS epidemic in Black America with a focus on how it's affecting Boston's communities of color. And I'm talking with Dr. Bisola Ojukwutu, who works at MGH in the infectious disease division. One of the pieces in the powerful documentary that is airing is on Frontline here at WGBH that I took away from was speaks directly to the stigma. And I wanted to play a clip from the documentary Endgame, AIDS in Black America, with a young man who, born in Boston, and who had to deal with this stigma.
My grandmother didn't like for people to be, like, afraid of me. So she would tell them before they got around me, so they wouldn't be all like, oh, I'm not going to eat near him because he's got something. And she'd be like, well, if you're not going to eat near him, then you can't eat near any of us because we eat near him. There was this one girl that was in my neighborhood, and I liked her. So I was like, oh, I like you a lot, blah, 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 but I should kind of tell you. And this is when I was first starting to do this. So I was like, I should tell you that I have HIV. And she was like, oh, yeah? And she was like cool with it that night. But then the next night she was like, I don't know. I'll talk to you later. Like, all right, I'll see you later. I was like, oh, wow. It's never happened.
That was pretty powerful. It's a young man. We're, you know, not yet in his, you know, even early 30s. And he was coming face to face to that stigma. So it's a powerful impact. And he was very frank about it, as you heard there. What I'm interested in is, are there still people, lots of people, in terms of the stigma, holding on to the fact that this is a gay disease, so therefore it cannot affect me? I mean, you said that people mostly know correctly how it's transmitted. But if you're still holding on to that, then you're not going to see yourself at risk. And you said risk, not understanding risk is a big part of this.
Right. It's an interesting dynamic. And I'm not sure that I can fully tease it out. Because when you look at our knowledge scale, you know, we were asking questions, like I said, do condoms used correctly each and every time protect you from HIV? And, you know, overwhelmingly people said yes. You know, are medications available? Yes. Do all women transmit HIV to their unborn children? And the answer is no. You know, and they seem to know these things, but just translating that into their actual behaviors just doesn't always seem to happen. I mean, it's more complicated than that, but I just don't think that, I think that people understand the theory But in terms of the practice and translating it into practice doesn't always happen. You know,
I'm curious, doctor, when patients come to you to interview you or to follow up on having been diagnosed with HIV, are most of them aware that they were, because we know that there are 20% of folks in America don't know that they have the disease. Mm-hmm. Were they shocked to find out they had it, or what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it depends on the patient. Mm-hmm. You know, what I've found is that oftentimes with Black women, you know, Black heterosexual women, what you'll find is that many of them were shocked. I mean, I had the privilege of previewing the documentary also, and there was a very emotional piece by a woman who married a man in her church. And that I thought that was very moving, and she didn't even, it didn't occur to her that this was something to be concerned about. At least that's what she got from what she said. And that resonated with me, because that's what many of my Black female patients seem to come to the table with, that they didn't realize that they were at risk. They didn't think this man who they loved was somebody who could potentially transmit HIV to them. So there is some shock. You know, other patients, you know, particularly some of my patients, men who are having sex with men, I think that there was some awareness that they were at risk, and maybe there's a little bit of maybe a bit of a more of a cavalier attitude.
I was going to say bravado, maybe.
Well, cavalier, right. You know, just sort of desensitization to this issue of HIV in certain groups, certain subpopulations. And you have less of that where, you know, they were just so shocked. But of course, you know, it's an emotional experience to be diagnosed with this life-threatening disease. So everybody, you know, has a reaction that's, you know, it's palpable. It's emotional.
I think we should also articulate that when you break down who in the community has the disease, that heterosexuals in Black communities, even by a small margin, are the most the highest numbers of infected people. And then you go on down to people who are having sex with men, and then, you know, maybe drug users or whatever. Mm-hmm. Access to treatment. That's a big part of a lot of discussion. You got the Magic Johnsons and the people who clearly can afford any kind of treatment. But there is good treatment, even though it's a tough regimen to take. But not everybody has access. Now, you said it's better here in Boston, but are people taking it, or how are they getting it, and how are they paying for it, blah, blah, blah.
Right. Well, here in Boston, I think that, as I mentioned, that there's this issue of healthcare reform. We have expanded access to Medicaid. We also have the Ryan White Care Act, which is a federally funded program that provides a safety net for those people who can't fully afford to pay for medications. And the information I gave you in terms of viral suppression basically indicates that if we have high levels of viral suppression, then people have access to treatment, so they're taking their medication. And I think it's important, again, to emphasize that if you look at Massachusetts data versus what's happening nationally, we have seen that there are higher levels of viral suppression here in this population and better survival over time, which means that people, you know, do have better access to care here.
And what we often hear, though, with is particularly among poorer populations, that people make decisions about what they can afford to do. Are they going to pay for food, or are they going to pay for drugs, even if they have some assistance in paying for it? Are you seeing that in your patients?
You know, I would have to say that I'm not. You know, I think that people make decisions not to take HIV medications for lots of reasons. Sometimes it's because they are fearful of the medications. You know, they're fearful of side effects. I think anytime you're giving somebody something that they think is strong or powerful, you know, they're worried about how it'll affect them. They're worried that they won't be able to stay adherent to the medication over time. And we tell them that if you not adherent to the medication, you might develop resistance, and then the medication will stop working. They may be, you know, afraid that other people will see them taking it, you know, and there's an internal stigma, and there's disclosure issues, and, you know, a lot of people don't want people to know that they're HIV infected. So there are many reasons that people, you know, may not want to take the medications. I haven't seen so much of people not taking it because they're fearful of cost, per se. But that certainly is a factor. It's certainly a factor. But in my own experience, I find that we try to assure people within our clinic that we can find a way to get you the medications.
So there was a new a big announcement just a week ago or so about this oral test for HIV. Now, for a layperson like myself, that seems like a great thing because you're doing it in the privacy of your home. But people have raised some issues about it. They say it's 92% effective, not 99% as it would be if you were going to your office. And in fact, one of the board members on the committee said, well, it's good, but not perfect, which doesn't inspire a lot of confidence. What's your take on this? Is this a boon or do you think this will be a problem?
So my feelings are mixed. I think that from the medical community standpoint, I think largely the response has been favorable. I think anything, people perceive that anything, any intervention that increases access to testing, increases access to knowledge of status is a good thing in some people's minds. My concern is actually it's based on a number of factors. One, the cost of the test. I mean, this isn't a free test where you'll be able to go into Walgreens and say, okay, I'd like to test for HIV. Give me the kit. You know, you're actually going to need to pay for it. And when you look at data that we have in the literature, when people have to pay for something, particularly an HIV test, they may defer, you know. So who is this test really going to be available for? I think the second thing that I'm concerned about is finding out that you're HIV positive. Remember, I mentioned to you just how emotional that can be for people and how devastating, especially if you didn't really think that you were at risk. You were just kind of taking it, you know, just because you thought it was a good thing to take it. Now, my understanding of with this oral test is that the reason why it may be higher cost, though I don't believe the cost has actually been determined, is because they're supposedly having 24-hour, you know, hotline available where there'll be people who can provide some counseling support. So that's a good thing, but is it enough? You know, the other thing that I wonder about is linkage to care. I mean, the big issue here that we have is that we need to link people to care as soon as possible because linkage to care and retention in care directly impacts survival. So if you have somebody out there who knows they're positive, but they're like, oh my gosh, I really don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. You know, is this hotline going to provide enough support? They say it is, but I don't know yet.
But with regard to the stigma, that's what I was thinking, you know, since it's so high in the Black community, if you're at home, at least, and I'm not, you know, putting down any of the many, many issues you just raised, it seems that that might get people to at least think about, well, have I put myself at risk and let me check? I don't know.
No, possibly. I mean, this test is actually a rapid test, just so I can tell people. So basically, it means that at home, you can take a swab and basically put it in your mouth. And then 20 to 40 minutes later, you'll find out if you're positive.
It's like a pregnancy test.
Right. It's like a pregnancy test. But there are older versions of the at-home test.
Oh,
and, yes. And I actually ordered it myself just to see, you know, you know, what it would be like to take it. But this was a finger stick. So you took you got the kit. It was an online kit. So they delivered it to my house. I pricked myself. I saw the blood, put it on a little a piece of paper, and I mailed it in somewhere. And then I called in and got the results.
Got you.
And then if there was a need for post-test counseling, then they offered that to you. You hit a button and you got the person on the line, apparently. I actually didn't do the post-test counseling, but
so
I really just wanted.
It could be a tool, but
so it could be, and it really hasn't necessarily increased. You know, now this may because it's rapid. We have to wait and see. You know, I'm trying to be positive, but I think I realize, just like you mentioned, that there's downsides to it.
Obstacles, as you see it, to those patients who are infected right now in Boston's Black community. You know, getting better. Do you see the numbers increasing, by the way? Because we've already said 30 to 40% of the infected population, period, in Boston is, you know, Black Americans. Or what do you see, in the next couple years or so?
Right. So I think that because of the concerted effort that's been put forth in Boston, both from a policy standpoint as well as an advocacy standpoint and the care and treatment access issues, I hope that we'll continue to see a decrease in the number of infections. I mean, as I mentioned, we have seen a decrease of more than 50% in terms of new infections in Boston. You know, it's always a concern when you look at issues of funding overall, and you look at the fact that the Ryan White Care Act is up for reauthorization next year, and even with the Affordable Care Act, which you know, across the nation will expand Medicaid in those states that opt into it, you know, we still need the Ryan White Care Act to cover social support services, you know, dental care, linkage to care, many other things. You know, we need that safety net. I mean, if we really want to nip this epidemic in the bud, we need to have the right structures in place. So that's what worries me. I mean, I think it worries all of us who are in this field in terms of access to care and retention in care, because it's not just about taking a pill every day. It's bigger than that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about the social support. It's about comprehensive medical care. You know, it's about all the things that go along with living with HIV. Many of my patients, you know, are living very chaotic lifestyles. They have untreated mental health issues. They have ongoing drug use. They're transiently housed. You know, when you have all of those issues that are going on, then if you look at your list of concerns, HIV isn't number one, you know? So you need the support systems to make HIV sort of the relevant piece of the entire picture and to get you through sort of all those other challenges that life has to offer.
So as from a health professional standpoint, what's the biggest challenge for you, understanding what you've just said and given the context of what's going on here in Boston and nationwide?
Mm. Well, as a healthcare provider, I think it's retention and care, you know, keeping people coming in to the doctor on a regular basis. I mean, as I said, retention is directly related to survival. I have so many patients who are lost to follow up, you know, just, you know, you don't see them for 6 months and you're like, where are they? And then finally we get a call from, you know, their parole officer or something and they're back in jail. And you're saying, well, what's going to happen to them there? You know, are they taking their medications there? Then when they get out of jail, you know, getting them reconnected into care. And if they haven't been on their medications, getting them, you know, back on their treatment. I think that as a healthcare provider, my biggest concern and my biggest stressor is realizing that it isn't just about my interaction with the patient in the room. There's so much that's going on out there, you know, in the world that's going to impact whether or not this patient stays in care and continues to take their medications. I mean, there's poverty and there's a huge income gap here in Boston between Blacks and whites, you know, and if you have people out there who, you know, maybe can't afford their food, you know, they're struggling on a daily basis, they're maybe engaging in other activities, as I mentioned, in terms of, you know, being in jail or in ongoing drug use. I mean, those are the things that I don't have direct control over.
Right.
You know, so as a healthcare provider, it's what we can wrap our arms around in the room that we feel most comfortable with, as opposed to the things outside that you just don't have as much control over and that, you know, we need strategies to address.
Well, certainly there's a spectrum of patients that you're seeing, including the ones who are living the chaotic lives and then the women that you mentioned who don't know and are shocked to find out that they're infected. And then, you know, there's children. There's, you know, any number of people that make up the mix of folks in Black Boston who are infected. I always ask this question because I think it's important for other people to engage in this. Why should, if I don't fit in any of those categories, why do I care about this?
That's that's an interesting question. You know, HIV just doesn't just touch the people who are infected. You know, it touches so much more than that. I mean, it's about whole communities. You know, it's about whole segments of the population here in Boston. And just because you're not one of those people, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't care about the other people. You know, and it's a communicable disease. You know, if something is transmitted sexually, then it's not like it's going to stay in one spot necessarily. People have sex with people outside of their community. People have sex with people, you know, who don't exactly look like them. And certainly injection drug use and other ways that HIV is transmitted, it's important to realize that it can affect you too. And you can't really discount that.
Any hope of the AIDS documentary by Frontline is called Endgame. Do you think we're at an endgame?
See, I want to say yes, but I think that my concern is that HIV in the Black community is the end result. It's the tragic result of these systemic issues that are bigger than this one virus. You know, we're talking about, like we said, this issue of stigma and homophobia and poverty. And we didn't talk about, we talked a little bit about incarceration and removing Black men from the community. I mean, Black people are the majority in the criminal justice system, you know, and you're having this breakdown of the family. I mean, all of these issues are there, yet you have this one virus that is sort of leads to. So you have to think bigger picture. You know, one biomedical intervention, one behavioral intervention is not going to solve all of this. We have to have bigger strategies, broader strategies that won't just have good after effects or ramifications for HIV, but for other chronic diseases. Mm. So we really have to think bigger.
Thank you so much for talking to us about this.
Thanks, Callie. Thank you for having
me. We've been talking about the AIDS in Black America about AIDS in Black America with a focus on the epidemic in Boston. I've been speaking with Dr. Bisola Ojukwutu. She works at MGH in the Infectious Disease Division. She also serves on the Board of Directors for AIDS Action Committee. Tonight at 9 on WGBH Channel 2, you can watch the Frontline documentary that explores this epidemic. It's called Endgame, AIDS in Black America. Looking for a good summer read? We'll hear about it. A Place for Me in the World, a new book written and edited by middle school students from the Mission Hill School in Roxbury. I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio.